Greater problem. Deserters now being summarily shot. XXXXX. Personal summary is that situation is still viable, but deteriorating slowly. XXXXXX. Communication ends. Landon, Zone 2, New York. In Boulder, Colorado, a rumor that the U.S. Meteorological Air Testing Center was really a biological warfare installation began to spread. The rumor was repeated on the air by a semi-delirious Denver FM disc jockey. By 11 p.m. on the night of June 26th, a vast, lemming-like exodus from Boulder had begun. A company of soldiers was sent out from Denver, Arvada, to stop them, but it was like sending a man with a whisk broom to clean out the Augean stables. Better than 11,000 civilians, sick, scared, and with no other thought than to put as many miles between themselves and the air testing center as possible, rolled over them. Thousands of other Boulderites fled to other points of the compass. At 11:15, a shattering explosion lit the night at the air testing center's location on Broadway. A young radical named Desmond Ramage had planted better than 16 pounds of plastique, originally earmarked for various Midwestern courthouses and state legislatures, in the ATC lobby. The explosive was great. The timer was cruddy. Ramage was vaporized, along with all sorts of harmless weather equipment and particle-for-particle pollution-measuring gadgets. Meanwhile, the exodus from Boulder went on. Communique 771, Zone 6, Secret, Scramble. From Gareth, Zone 6, Little Rock, to Creighton, Commanding, Ray, Operation Carnival. Follows. Brodsky neutralized. Repeat, Brodsky neutralized. He was found working in a storefront clinic here, tried and summarily executed for treason against the United States of America. Some of those being treated attempted to interfere. 14 civilians shot, 6 killed. 3 of my men wounded, none seriously. X. Zone 6 forces this area working at only 40% capacity. Estimate 25% of those still on active duty now ill with superflu. 15% AWOL. XX. Most serious incident in regard to contingency plan F for Frank. XXX. Sergeant T.L. Peters, stationed Carthage, Missouri, on emergency duty Springfield, Missouri, apparently assassinated by own men. XXXX. Other incidents of similar nature possible but unconfirmed. Situation deteriorating rapidly. XXXXX. Communication ends. Garfield, Zone 6, Little Rock. When the evening was spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table, 2,000 students attending Kent State University in Ohio went on the warpath. Big time. The 2,000 riders consisted of first mini-semester summer students, members of a symposium on the future of college journalism, 120 attendees of a drama workshop, and 200 members of the Future Farmers of America, Ohio branch, whose convention happened to coincide with the grass fire spread of the superflu. All of them had been cooped up on the campus since June 22nd, 4 days ago. What follows is a transcription of police band communications in the area, spanning the time period 7:16 to 7:22 p.m. Unit 16, Unit 16, do you copy? Over. Copy, Unit 20, over. We got a group of kids coming down the mall here, 16. About 70 warm bodies, I'd say, and... check that, Unit 16. We got another group coming the other way. Jesus, 200 or more in that one, looks like. Over. Unit 20, this is base. Do you copy? Over. Read you 5 by base. Over. I'm sending Chum and Halliday over. Block the road with your car. Take no other action. If they go over you, spread your legs and enjoy it. No resistance. Do you copy? Over. I copy. No resistance, base. What are those soldiers doing over on the eastern side of the mall, base? Over. What soldiers? Over. That's what I asked you, base. They're... Base, this is Dudley Chum. Oh, shit, this is Unit 12. Sorry, Base. There's a bunch of kids coming down Burroughs Drive, about 150, headed for the mall, singing or chanting or some damn thing. But, Cap, Jesus Christ, we see soldiers, too. They're wearing gas masks, I think. They look to be in a skirmish line. That's what it looks like, anyway. Over. Base to Unit 12. Join Unit 20 at the foot of the mall. Same instructions. No resistance. Over. Roger, base. I am rolling. Over. Base, this is Unit 17. This is Halliday Base. Do you copy? Over.
I copy, 17. Over.
I'm behind Chum. There's another 200 kids coming west to east toward the mall. They got signs, just like in the 60s. One says, soldiers, throw down your guns. I see another one that says, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I don't give a shit what the signs say, Unit 17. Get down there with Chum and Peters and block them off. It sounds like they're headed into a tornado. Over.
Roger. Over and out.
This is Campus Security Chief Richard Burley now speaking to the head of the military forces encamped on the south side of this campus. Repeat. This is Campus Security Chief Burley. I know you've been monitoring our communications, so please spare me the ducking and fucking and acknowledge. Over.
This is Colonel Albert Phillips, U.S. Army. We are listening, Chief Burley. Over.
Base, this is Unit 16. The kids are coming together at the war memorial. They appear to be turning toward the soldiers. This looks nasty. Over.
This is Burley, Colonel Phillips. Please state your intentions. Over.
My orders are to contain those present on campus to the campus. My only intention is to follow my orders. If those people are just demonstrating, they are fine. If they intend to try breaking out of quarantine, they are not. Over.
You surely don't mean...
I mean what I said, Chief Burley. Over and out.
Phillips? Phillips, answer me, goddamn you. Those aren't commie gorillas out there. They're kids, American kids. They aren't armed. They're
Unit 13 to base. Those kids are walking right toward the soldiers, Cap. They're waving their signs, singing that song, the one the Baez crotch used to sing.
Oh, shit, I think some of them are throwing rocks. Oh, Jesus Christ, they can't do that.
Base to Unit 13, what's going on out there? What's happening?
This is Chum, Dick. I'll tell you what's happening out here. It's a slaughter. I wish I was blind. Oh, the fuckers! They're mowing those kids down with machine guns, it looks like. As far as I can tell, there wasn't even any warning. The kids that are still on their feet, they're breaking up, running to all points of the compass. Oh, Christ, I just saw a girl cut in half by gunfire. Blood, there must be 70, 80 kids lying out there in the grass.
Chum, come in. Come in, Unit 12.
Base, this is Unit 17. Do you copy? Over.
I copy you, goddammit, but where's fucking Chum? Fucking over.
Chum and Halliday, I think, got out of their cars for a better look.
We're coming back, Dick. Now it looks like the soldiers are shooting each other. I don't know who's winning, and I don't care. Whoever it is will probably start on us next. When those of us who can get back do get back, I suggest that we all go down in the basement and wait for them to use up their ammo. Over.
Goddammit.
The turkey shoot's still going on, Dick. I'm not kidding. Over. Out.
Through most of the running exchange transcribed above, the listener can hear faint popping sounds in the background, not unlike horse chestnuts in a hot fire. One may also hear thin screams. And in the last 40 seconds or so, the heavy, coughing thump of mortar rounds exploding. Following is a transcription taken from a special high-frequency radio band in Southern California. The transcription was made from 7:17 to 7:20 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Massengill Zone 10. Are you there, Blue Base? This message is coded Annie Oakley. Urgent plus 10. Come in if you're there. Over.
This is Len, David. We can skip the jargon, I think. Nobody's listening.
It's out of control, Len. Everything. L.A. is going up in flames, the whole fucking city and everything around it. All my men are sick of rioting or AWOL or looting right along with the civilian population. I'm in the skylight room of the Bank of America, main branch. There's over 600 people trying to get in and get at me. Most of them are regular army.
Things fall apart. The center does not hold.
Say again, I didn't copy.
Never mind. Can you get out?
Hell no. But I'll give the first of the scum something to think about. I've got a recoilless rifle here.
Scum. Fucking scum.
Luck, David.
You too. Hold it together as long as you can.
Will do.
I'm not sure.
Verbal communication ends at this point. There is a splintering, crashing sound, the screech of giving metal, the tinkle of breaking glass, a great many yelling voices.
Small arms fire, and then, very close to the radio transmitter, close enough to distort, the heavy, thudding explosions of what might very well be a recoilless rifle. The yelling, roaring voices draw closer. There is the whining sound of a ricochet, a scream very close to the transmitter, a thud, and silence. Following is a transcription taken from the regular army band in San Francisco. The transcription was made from 7:28 to 7:30 p.m. PST.
Soldiers and brothers, we have taken the radio station and the command HQ. Your oppressors are dead. I, Brother Zeno, until moments ago Sergeant First Class Roland Gibbs, proclaim myself First President of the Republic of Northern California. We are in control. We are in control. If your officers in the field try to countermand my orders, shoot them like dogs in the street, like dogs, like bitches with shit drying on their rumps. Take down name, rank, and serial numbers of deserters. List those that speak sedition or treason against the Republic of Northern California. A new day is dawning. The day of the oppressor is ended. We are... A rattle of machine gun fire. Screams, thumps, and thuds. Pistol shots, more screams, a sustained burst of machine gun fire, a long dying moan. 3 seconds of dead air.
This is Major Alfred Nunn, United States Army. I'm taking provisional and temporary control of United States forces in the San Francisco area. The handful of traitors present in this HQ have been dealt with. I am in command, repeat, in command. The holding operation will go on. Deserters and defectors will be dealt with as before. Extreme prejudice. Repeat. Extreme prejudice. I am now...
More gunfire. A scream. Background.
Them all! Get them all! Death to the war pigs!
Heavy gunfire. Then silence on the band. At 9:16 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, those still well enough to watch television in the Portland, Maine area tuned in WCSH-TV and watched with numbed horror as a huge black man, naked except for a pink leather loincloth and a Marine officer's cap, obviously ill, performed a series of 62 public executions. His colleagues, also black, also nearly naked, all wore loincloths and some badge of rank to show they had once belonged in the military. They were armed with automatic and semi-automatic weapons. In the area where a studio audience had once watched local political debates and dialing for dollars, more members of this black junta covered perhaps 200 khaki-clad soldiers with rifles and handguns. The huge black man, who grinned a lot, showing amazingly even and white teeth in his coal-black face, was holding a .45 automatic pistol and standing beside a large glass drum. In a time that already seemed long ago, that drum had held scraps of cut-up telephone books for the Dialing for Dollars program. Now he spun it, pulled out a driver's license, and called,
PFC Franklin Stern, front and center, police!
The armed men flanking the audience on all sides bent to look at name tags while a cameraman, obviously new to the trade, panned the audience in jerky sweeps. At last a young man with light blonde hair, no more than 19, was jerked to his feet, screaming and protesting, and led up to the set area. Two of the blacks forced him to his knees. The black man grinned, sneezed, spat phlegm, and put the .45 automatic to PFC Stern's temple.
"No!" Stern cried hysterically. "I'll come in with you, honest to God, I will. I'll—"
"In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost,"
the big black man intoned, grinning, and pulled the trigger. There was a large smear of blood and brains behind the spot where PFC Stern was being forced to kneel, and now he added his own contribution. Splat. The black man sneezed again and almost fell over. Another black man, this one in the control room, he was wearing a green long-billed fatigue cap and pristine white jockey shorts, pushed the applause button. And in front of the studio audience, the sign flashed on. The blacks guarding the audience prisoners raised their weapons threateningly, and the captive white soldiers, their faces glistening with perspiration and terror, applauded wildly.
"Next,"
the black man in the loincloth proclaimed hoarsely, and delved into the drum again. He looked at the slip and announced,
"Master Tech Sergeant Roger Peterson, front and center, police!"
A man in the audience began to howl and made an abortive dive for the back doors. Seconds later, he was up on stage. In the confusion, one of the men in the third row tried to remove the name tag pinned to his blouse. One shot banged out, and he slumped down in his seat, his eyes glazed as if such a tawdry show had bored him into a death-like semi-doze. This spectacle went on until almost 11:15, when four squads of regular army, wearing respirators and carrying submachine guns, crashed into the studio. The two dying groups of soldiers immediately went to war. The black man in the loincloth went down almost immediately, cursing, sweating, riddled with bullets, and firing his automatic pistol crazily into the floor. The renegade who had been operating the number 2 camera was shot in the belly, and as he leaned forward to catch his spilling guts, his camera pivoted slowly around, giving the audience a leisurely pan shot of hell. The semi-naked guards were returning fire, and the soldiers in the respirators were spraying the entire audience area. The unarmed soldiers in the middle, instead of being rescued, found that their executions had only been speeded up. A young man with carroty hair and a wild expression of panic on his face climbed over the backs of 6 rows of seats like a circus performer on stilts before his legs were chewed away by a stream of .45-caliber bullets. Others crawled up the carpeted aisles between rows, their noses to the floor, the way they had been taught to crawl under live machine gun fire in basic training. An aging sergeant with gray hair stood up, arms spread wide like a TV host, and screamed, "Stop!" at the top of his lungs. Heavy fire from both sides homed in on him, and he began to jig-a-jig like a disintegrating puppet. The roar of the guns and the screams of the dying and wounded made the audio needles in the control room jump over to plus 50 dB. The camera operator fell forward over the handle that controlled his camera, and those watching were now given only a merciful view of the studio ceiling for the rest of the exchange. The gunfire diminished over a period of 5 minutes to isolated explosions, then to nothing. Only the screams went on. At 11:05, the studio ceiling was replaced on home screens by a picture of a cartoon man who was staring glumly at a cartoon TV. On the cartoon TV was a sign that said, "Sorry, we are having problems." As the evening wound toward its close, that was true of almost everyone. In Des Moines, at 11:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, an old Buick covered with religious stickers, "Honk if you love Jesus," among others, cruised the deserted downtown streets relentlessly. There had been a fire in Des Moines earlier in the day that had burned most of the south side of Hull Avenue and Grandview Junior College. Later, there had been a riot that gutted most of the downtown area. When the sun went down, these streets had been filled with restlessly circling crowds of people, most of them under 25, many riding choppers. They had broken windows, stolen TV sets, filled their gas tanks at service stations, while watching for anyone who might have a gun. Now the streets were empty. Some of them, the bikers mainly, were kicking out their remaining jams on Interstate 80. But most of them had crept into houses and locked the doors, already suffering with superflu or only terror of it as daylight left this flat green land. Now Des Moines looked like the aftermath of some monster New Year's Eve party, after sodden sleep had claimed the last of the revelers. The Buick's tires whispered and crunched over the broken glass in the street and turned west from 14th onto Euclid Avenue, passing two cars that had crashed head-on and now lay on their sides with their bumpers interlaced like lovers after a successful double homicide. There was a loudspeaker on top of the Buick's roof, and now it began to give off amplified boops and beeps, followed by the scratchy sounds of an old record's opening grooves, and then, blaring up and down the spectral deserted streets of Des Moines, came the sweetly droning voice of Mother Maybelle Carter, singing "Keep on the Sunny Side." "Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side, keep on the sunny side of life. Though your problems may be many, it will seem you don't have any if you keep on the sunny side of life." The old Buick cruised on and on, making figure eights, loops, sometimes circling the same block 3 or 4 times. When it hit a bump or rolled over a body, the record would skip. At 11:40, the Buick pulled over to the curb and idled. Then it began to roll again. The loudspeaker blared Elvis Presley singing "The Old Rugged Cross," and a night wind soughed through the trees and stirred a final whiff of smoke from the smoldering ruins of the junior college. From the President's speech, delivered at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, not seen in many areas. A great nation such as this must do. We cannot afford to jump at shadows like small children in a dark room. But neither can we afford to take this serious outbreak of influenza lightly. My fellow Americans, I urge you to stay at home. If you feel ill, stay in bed, take aspirin, and drink plenty of clear liquids. Be confident that you will feel better in a week at most. Let me repeat what I said at the beginning of my talk to you this evening. There is no truth, no truth, to the rumor that this strain of flu is fatal. In the greatest majority of cases, the person afflicted can expect to be up and around and feeling fine within a week. Further, a spasm of coughing. Further, there has been a vicious rumor promulgated by certain radical anti-establishment groups that this strain of influenza has been somehow bred by this government for some possible military use. Fellow Americans, this is a flat-out falsehood, and I want to brand it as such right here and now. This country signed the revised Geneva Accords on poison gas, nerve gas, and germ warfare in good conscience and in good faith. We have not now, nor have we ever... A spasm of sneezes. Have we ever been a party to the clandestine manufacture of substances outlawed by the Geneva Convention? This is a moderately serious outbreak of influenza, no more and no less. We have reports tonight of outbreaks in a score of other countries, including Russia and Red China. Therefore, we... A spasm of coughs and sneezes. We ask you to remain calm and secure in the knowledge that late this week or early next... A flu vaccine will be available for those not already on the mend. National Guardsmen have been called out in some areas to protect the populace against hooligans, vandals, and scaremongers, but there's absolutely no truth to the rumors that some cities have been occupied by regular army forces or that the news has been managed. My fellow Americans, this is a flat-out falsehood, and I want to brand it as such right here and... Graffito written on the front of the First Baptist Church of Atlanta in red spray paint. Dear Jesus, I will see you soon. Your friend, America. P.S. I hope you will still have some vacancies by the end of the week. Chapter 27 Larry Underwood sat on a bench in Central Park on the morning of June 27th, looking into the menagerie. Behind him, Fifth Avenue was crazily jammed with cars, all of them silent now, their owners dead or fled. Farther down Fifth, many of the posh shops were smoking rubble. From where Larry sat, he could see a lion, an antelope, a zebra, and some sort of monkey. All but the monkey were dead. They had not died of the flu, Larry judged. They had gotten no food or water for God knew how long, and that had killed them. All but the monkey... And in the 3 hours that Larry had been sitting here, the monkey had moved only 4 or 5 times. The monkey had been smart enough to outwit starvation or death by thirst, so far, but it surely had a good case of superflu. That was one monkey who was hurting for certain. It was a hard old world. To his right, the clock with all the animals chimed the hour of 11. The clockwork figures, which had once delighted all children, now played to an empty house. The bear tooted his horn, a clockwork monkey who would never get sick, but who might eventually run down, played a tambourine. The elephant beat his drum with his trunk. Heavy tunes, baby, heavy fucking tunes. End of the world suite arranged for clockwork figures. After a bit, the clock fell silent, and he could hear the horse shouting again, now mercifully faint with distance. The monster shouter was somewhere off to Larry's left this fine forenoon, perhaps in the Heckscher playground. Maybe he would fall into the wading pool there and drown.
"Monster's coming!" the faint hoarse voice cried.
The overcast had broken this morning, and the day was bright and hot. A bee cruised past Larry's nose, circled one of the nearby flower beds, and made a 3-point landing on a peony.
From the menagerie came the soothing, soporific drone of the flies as they landed on the dead animals.
"Monsters coming now!"
The monster shouter was a tall man who looked to be in his middle 60s. Larry had first heard him the night before, which he had spent in the Sherry Netherland. With night lying over the unnaturally quiet city, the faint, howling voice had seemed sonorous and dark, the voice of a lunatic Jeremiah floating through the streets of Manhattan, echoing, rebounding, distorting. Larry, lying sleepless in a queen-sized double with every light in the suite blazing, had become irrationally convinced that the monster shouter was coming for him, seeking him out, the way the creatures of his frequent bad dreams sometimes did. For a long time it had seemed that the voice was drawing ever closer.
"Monsters coming! Monsters on the way! They're in the suburbs!"
And Larry became convinced that the suite's door, which he had triple-locked, would burst inward, and that the monster shouter would be there. Not a human being at all, but a gigantic troll thing with the head of a dog and saucer-sized fly eyes and champing teeth. But earlier this morning, Larry had seen him in the park, and he was only a crazy old man wearing corduroy pants and zoris and horn-rimmed glasses with one bow taped. Larry had tried to speak to him, and the monster shouter had run in terror, crying back over his shoulder that the monsters would be in the streets at any moment. He had tripped over an ankle-high wire fence and went sprawling on one of the bike paths with a loud comic thwap sound, his glasses flying off but not shattering. Larry had gone to him, but before he could get there, the monster shouter had scooped up his glasses and was gone toward the mall, crying his endless warning. So Larry's opinion of him had swung from extreme terror to utter boredom and mild annoyance in the space of 12 hours. There were other people in the park. Larry had spoken to a few of them. They were all pretty much the same, and Larry supposed that he himself wasn't much different. They were dazed, their speech disjointed, and they seemed helpless to stop reaching for your sleeve with their hands as they talked. They had stories to tell. All the stories were the same. Their friends and relatives were dead or dying. There had been shooting in the streets. There had been an inferno on Fifth Avenue. Was it true that Tiffany's was gone? Could that be true? Who was going to clean up? Who was going to collect the garbage? Should they get out of New York? They had heard that troops were guarding all the places where one could hope to do this. One woman was terrified that the rats were going to rise up out of the subways and inherit the earth, reminding Larry uneasily of his own thoughts on the day he had first returned to New York. A young man munching Fritos from a gigantic bag told Larry conversationally that he was going to fulfill a lifetime ambition. He was going to Yankee Stadium, run around the outfield naked, and then masturbate on home plate. "Chance of a lifetime, man," he told Larry, winked with both eyes, and then wandered off, eating Fritos. Many of the people in the park were sick, but not many had died there. Perhaps they had uneasy thoughts of being munched for dinner by the animals, and they had crawled indoors when they felt the end was near. Larry had had only one confrontation with death this morning, and one was all he wanted. He had walked up transverse number 1 to the comfort station there. He had opened the door, and a grinning dead man with maggots crawling briskly hither and yon on his face had been seated inside, his hands settled on his bare thighs, his sunken eyes staring into Larry's own. A sickening sweet smell bloated out at Larry as if the man sitting there was a rancid bonbon, a sweet treat which, in all the confusion, had been left for the flies. Larry slammed the door shut, but belatedly. He lost the cornflakes he had eaten for breakfast, and then dry-heaved until he was afraid he might rupture some of his inner workings. "God, if you're there," he had prayed as he stumbled back toward the menagerie. "If you're taking requests today, big fella, mine is not to have to look at anything else like that today. The kooks are bad enough. Something like that is more than I can take. Thank you so much." Now, sitting on this bench, the monster shouter had moved out of earshot, at least temporarily, Larry found himself thinking about the World Series 5 years ago. It was good to remember that because it now seemed to him that was the last time he had been completely happy, his physical condition tip-top, his mind resting easily and not working against itself. That had been just after he and Rudy split up. That had been a damn piss-poor thing, that split up. And if he ever saw Rudy again, Never happen, his mind told him with a sigh. Larry was going to apologize. He would get down and kiss Rudy's shoe tops, if that was what Rudy needed to make it okay again. They had started off across the country in a wheezy old 1968 Mercury that had shat its transmission in Omaha. From there on, they would work for a couple of weeks, hitchhike west for a while, work another couple of weeks, then hitchhike some more. For a while, they worked on a farm in western Nebraska, just below the Panhandle. And one night, Larry had lost $60 in a poker game. The next day, he'd had to ask Rudy for a loan to tide him over. They had arrived in L.A. a month later, and Larry had been the first to land a job, if you want to call washing dishes for the minimum wage working. One night about 3 weeks later, Rudy had broached the subject of the loan. He said he'd met a guy who'd recommended a really good employment agency, never miss, but the fee was $25, which happened to be the amount of the loan he had made to Larry after the poker game. Ordinarily, Rudy said, he never would have asked, but... Larry had protested that he'd paid the loan back. They were square. If Rudy wanted the 25, okay, but he just hoped Rudy wasn't trying to get him to pay off the same loan twice. Rudy said he didn't want a gift. He wanted the money he was owed, and he wasn't interested in a lot of Larry Underwood bullshit either. Jesus Christ, Larry said, trying a good-humored laugh. I never thought I'd need a receipt from you, Rudy. Guess I was wrong. It had escalated into a full-scale argument, almost to the point of blows. At the end, Rudy's face had been flushed. "That's you, Larry," he'd shouted. "That's you all over. That's how you are. I used to think I'd never learn my lesson, but I think I finally did. Fuck off, Larry." Rudy left, and Larry followed him to the stairs of the cheap rooming house, digging his wallet out of his back pocket. There were 3 tens neatly folded into the secret compartment behind the photos, and he had heaved them after Rudy. "Go on, you cheap little lying fuck. Take it. Take the goddamn money." Rudy had slammed the outer door open with a bang and had gone out into the night, toward whatever tin destiny the Rudys of this world can expect. He didn't look back. Larry had stood at the top of the stairs, breathing hard, and after a minute or so he had looked around for his 3 $10 bills, gathered them up, and put them away again. Thinking of the incident now and then over the years, he had become more and more sure that Rudy had been right. Actually, he was positive. Even if he had paid Rudy back, the two of them had been friends since grade school, and it seemed, looking back, that Larry had always been a dime short for the Saturday matinee because he'd bought some licorice whips or a couple of candy bars on the way over to Rudy's, or borrowing a nickel to round out his school lunch money, or getting 7 cents to make up car fare. Over the years, he must have bummed $50 in change from Rudy, maybe 100. When Rudy had braced him for that 25, Larry could remember the way he had tightened up. His brain had subtracted $25 from the 3 tens, and had said to him, "That only leaves $5. Therefore, you already paid him back. I'm not sure just when, but you did. Let's have no more discussion of the matter." And no more there had been. But after that, he had been alone in the city. He had no friends, hadn't even attempted to make any at the cafe on Encino where he worked. The fact was, he'd believed everyone who worked there, from the evil-tempered head cook to the ass-wiggling, gum-chewing waitresses, had been a dipstick. Yes, he had really believed everyone at Tony's Feedbag was a dipstick but him, the sainted, soon-to-succeed, and you better believe it, Larry Underwood. Alone in a world of dipsticks, he felt as achy as a whipped dog and as homesick as a man marooned on a desert island. He began to think more and more of buying a Greyhound Ameripass and dragging himself back to New York. In another month, maybe even another 2 weeks, he would have done it, too, except for Yvonne. He met Yvonne Wetterlin at a movie theater 2 blocks from the club where she worked as a topless dancer. When the second show let out, she had been weeping and searching around her seat on the aisle for her purse. It had her driver's license in it, also her checkbook, her union card, her one credit card, a photostat of her birth certificate, and her social security card. Although he was positive it had been stolen, Larry did not say so and helped her look for it.
and sometimes it seemed they really must live in a world of wonders, because he had found it 3 rows down just as they were about to give up. He guessed it had probably migrated down there as a result of people shuffling their feet as they watched the picture, which had really been pretty boring. She had hugged him and wept as she thanked him. Larry, feeling like Captain America, told her he wished he could take her out for burgers or something to celebrate, only he was really strapped for cash. Yvonne said she'd treat. Larry, that great prince, had been pretty sure she would. They started to see each other. In less than 2 weeks, they had a regular thing going. Larry found a better job, clerking in a bookstore, and had gotten a gig singing with a group called the Hotshot Rhythm Rangers and All-Time Boogie Band. The name was the best thing about the group, actually, but the rhythm guitarist had been Johnny McCall, who later went on to form the Tattered Remnants, and that was actually a pretty good band. Larry and Yvonne moved in together, and for Larry, everything changed. Part of it was just having a place, his own place, that he was paying half the rent for. Yvonne put up some curtains, they got some cheap thrift shop furniture and refinished it together. Other members of the band and some of Yvonne's friends started to drop around. The place was bright in the daytime, and at night, a fragrant California breeze, which seemed redolent with oranges even when the only thing it was really redolent with was smog, would drift in through the windows. Sometimes no one would come, and he and Yvonne would just watch television. And sometimes she would bring him a can of beer and sit on the arm of his chair and rub his neck. It was his own place, a home, goddammit. And sometimes he'd lie awake in bed at night with Yvonne sleeping beside him and marvel at how good he felt. Then he would slip smoothly into sleep, and it was the sleep of the just, and he never did think of Rudy Marx at all. At least, not much. They lived together for 14 months, all of it fine until the last 6 weeks or so, when Yvonne got to be kind of a bitch, and the part of it that summed it all up for Larry was that World Series. He would put in his day at the bookstore, then go over to Johnny McCall's house, and the two of them, the whole group only practiced on weekends because the other two guys had night jobs, would work on some new stuff or maybe just hack away at the great oldies, the ones Johnny called real bar rippers, tunes like Nobody But Me and Double Shot of My Baby's Love. Then he'd go home, to his home, and Yvonne would have dinner already. Not just TV dinners, shit like that either. Real home cooking. Girl was well trained. And afterward they would go into the living room and turn on the tube and watch the series. Later, love. It had seemed all right. It had all seemed his. There hadn't been one single thing hassling his mind. Nothing had been so good since then. Nothing. He realized he was crying a little bit, and he felt a momentary disgust that he should be sitting here on a bench in Central Park, crying in the sun like some wretched old man on a pension. Then it occurred to him that he had a right to cry for the things he had lost, that he had a right to be in shock, if that was what this was. His mother had died 3 days ago. She had been lying on a cot in the hallway of Mercy Hospital when she died, crammed in with thousands of others who were also busy dying. Larry had been kneeling beside her when she went, and he had thought he might go mad, watching his mother die while all around him rose the stench of urine and feces, the hell's babble of the delirious, the choking, the insane, the screams of the bereaved. She hadn't known him at the end. There had been no final moment of recognition. Her chest had finally just stopped in mid-heave and had settled very slowly, like the weight of an automobile settling down on a flat tire. He had crouched beside her for 10 minutes or so, not knowing what to do, thinking in a confused way that he ought to wait until a death certificate was signed or someone asked him what had happened. But it was obvious what had happened. It was happening everywhere. It was just as obvious that the place was a madhouse. No sober young doctor was going to come along, express sympathy, and then start the machinery of death. Sooner or later, his mother would just be carried away like a sack of oats, and he didn't want to watch that. Her purse was under the cot. He found a pen and a bobby pin and her checkbook. He tore a deposit slip from the back of her book and wrote on it her name, her address, and after a moment's calculation, her age. He clipped it to her blouse pocket with the bobby pin and began to cry. He kissed her cheek and fled, crying. He felt like a deserter.
Being on the street had been a little better, although at that time the streets had been full of crazy people, sick people, and circling army patrols. And now he could sit on this bench and grieve for more general things. His mother's loss of her retirement, the loss of his own career, for that time in L.A. when he had sat watching the World Series with Yvonne, knowing there would be bed and love later. And for Rudy. Most of all, he grieved for Rudy, and wished he had paid Rudy his $25 with a grin and a shrug, saving the 6 years that had been lost. The monkey died at 11:45. It was on its perch, just sitting there apathetically with its hands drawn up under its chin. And then its eyelids fluttered and it fell forward and hit the cement with a final horrid smack. Larry didn't want to sit there anymore. He got up and began to walk aimlessly down toward the mall with its large band shell. He had heard the monster shouter some 15 minutes ago, very far away, but now the only sound in the park seemed to be his own heels clicking on the cement and the twitter of the birds. Birds apparently didn't catch the flu. Good for them. When he neared the band shell, he saw that a woman was sitting on one of the benches in front of it. She was maybe 50, but had taken great pains to look younger. She was dressed in expensive-looking gray-green slacks and a silk off-the-shoulder peasant blouse. Except, Larry thought, as far as he knew, peasants can't afford silk. She looked around at the sound of Larry's footsteps. She had a pill in one hand and tossed it casually into her mouth like a peanut. "Hi," Larry said. Her face was calm, her eyes blue. Sharp intelligence gleamed in them. She was wearing gold-rimmed glasses, and her pocketbook was trimmed with something that certainly looked like mink. There were 4 rings on her fingers, a wedding band, 2 diamonds, and a cat's eye emerald. "I'm not dangerous," he said. It was a ridiculous thing to say, he supposed, but she looked like she might be wearing about $20,000 on her fingers. Of course they might be fakes, but she didn't look like a woman who would have much use for paste and zircons. "No," she said. "You don't look dangerous. You're not sick, either." Her voice rose a little on the last word, making her statement into a polite half-question. She wasn't as calm as she looked at first glance. There was a little tick working on the side of her neck, and behind the lively intelligence in the blue eyes was the same dull shock that Larry had seen in his own eyes this morning as he shaved. "No, I don't think I am. Are you?" "Not at all. Did you know you have an ice cream wrapper on your shoe?" He looked down and saw that he did. It made him blush because he suspected that she would have informed him that his fly was open in that same tone. He stood on one leg and tried to pull it off. "You look like a stork," she said. "Sit down and try it. My name is Rita Blakemore." "Pleased to know you. I'm Larry Underwood." He sat down. She offered her hand, and he shook it lightly, his fingers pressing against her rings. Then he gingerly removed the ice cream wrapper from his shoe and dropped it primly into a can beside the bench that said, "It's your park, so keep it clean." It struck him funny, the whole operation. He threw his head back and laughed. It was the first real laugh since the day he had come home to find his mother lying on the floor of her apartment. And he was enormously relieved to find that the good feel of laughing hadn't changed. It rose from your belly and escaped from between your teeth in the same jolly go-to-hell way. Rita Blakemore was smiling both at him and with him, and he was struck again by her casual yet elegant handsomeness. She looked like a woman from an Irwin Shaw novel. Night Work, maybe, or the one they had made for TV when he was just a kid. "When I heard you coming, I almost hid," she said. "I thought you were probably the man with the broken glasses and the queer philosophy." "The monster shouter? Is that what you call him, or is that what he calls himself?" "What I call him." "Very apt," she said, opening her mink-trimmed, maybe, bag and taking out a package of menthol cigarettes. "He reminds me of an insane Diogenes." "Yeah, just looking for an honest monster," Larry said, and laughed again. She lit her cigarette and chuffed out smoke. "He's not sick either," Larry said. "But most of the others are." "The doorman at my building seems very well," Rita said. "He's still on duty. I tipped him $5 when I came out this morning.
I don't know if I tipped him for being very well or for being on duty. What do you think?
I really don't know you well enough to say.
No, of course you don't.
She put her cigarettes back in her bag, and he saw that there was a revolver in there. She followed his gaze.
It was my husband's. He was a career executive with a major New York bank. That's just how he put it when anyone asked what he did to keep himself in cocktail onions. I'm a career executive with a major New York bank. He died 2 years ago. He was at a luncheon with one of those Arabs who always look as if they have rubbed all the visible areas of their skin with Brill cream. He had a massive stroke. He died with his tie on. Do you think that could be our generation's equivalent of that old saying about dying with your boots on? Harry Blakemore died with his tie on. I like it, Larry.
A finch landed in front of them and pecked the ground.
He was insanely afraid of burglars, so he had this gun. Do guns really kick and make a loud noise when they go off, Larry?
Larry, who had never fired a gun in his life, said, I don't think one that size would kick much. Is it a 38?
I believe it's a 32.
She took it out of her bag, and he saw there were also a good many small pill bottles in there. This time she didn't follow his gaze. She was looking at a small chinaberry tree about 15 paces away.
I believe I'll try it. Do you think I can hit that tree?
I don't know, he said apprehensively. I don't really think... She pulled the trigger, and the gun went off with a fairly impressive bang. A small hole appeared in the chinaberry tree.
Bullseye, she said, and blew smoke from the pistol barrel like a gunfighter.
Real good, Larry said, and when she put the gun back in her purse, his heart resumed something like its normal rhythm.
I couldn't shoot a person with it, I'm quite sure of that. And soon there won't be anyone to shoot, will there?
Oh, I don't know about that.
You were looking at my rings. Would you like one?
Huh? No.
He began to blush again. As a banker, my husband believed in diamonds. He believed in them the way the Baptists believe in revelations. I have a great many diamonds, and they are all insured. We not only owned a piece of the rock, my Harry and I sometimes believed we held a lien on the whole goddamn thing. But if someone should want my diamonds, I would hand them over. After all, they're only rocks again, aren't they?
I guess that's right.
Of course, she said, and the tick on the side of her neck jumped again. And if a stick-up man wanted them, I'd not only hand them over, I would give him the address of Cartier's. Their selection of rocks is much better than my own.
What are you going to do now? Larry asked her.
What would you suggest?
I just don't know, Larry said, and sighed.
My answer exactly.
You know something? I saw a guy this morning who said he was going out to Yankee Stadium and masturbate on home plate. He could feel himself blushing again.
What an awful walk for him, she said.
Why didn't you suggest something closer?
She sighed, and the sigh turned into a shudder. She opened her purse, took out a bottle of pills, and popped a gel capsule into her mouth.
What's that? Larry asked.
Vitamin E, she said with a glittering false smile. The tick in her neck jumped once or twice and then stopped. She became serene again.
There's nobody in the bars, Larry said suddenly. I went into Pat's on 43rd and it was totally empty. They have that great big mahogany bar and I went behind it and poured myself a water glass full of Johnny Walker. Then I didn't even want to be there. So I left it sitting on the bar and got out.
They sighed together, like a chorus.
You're very pleasant to be with, she said. I like you very much, and it's wonderful that you're not crazy.
Thank you, Mrs. Blakemore.
He was surprised and pleased.
Rita. I'm Rita.
Okay.
Are you hungry, Larry?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Perhaps you'd take the lady to lunch.
That would be a pleasure.
She stood up and offered him her arm with a slightly deprecatory smile. As he linked his through it, he caught a whiff of her sachet, a smell that was at once comforting and disquietingly adult in its associations for him. Almost old. His mother had worn sachet on their many trips to the movies together.
Then he forgot about it as they walked out of the park and up Fifth Avenue, away from the dead monkey, the monster shouter, and the dark sweet treat sitting endlessly inside the comfort station on Transverse Number 1. She chattered incessantly, and later he could remember no one thing she had chattered about. Yes, just one. She had always dreamed, she said, of strolling up Fifth Avenue on the arm of a handsome young man. A man who was young enough to have been her own son, but who wasn't. But he recalled the walk often, just the same, especially after she began to jitter apart like some indifferently made toy. Her beautiful smile, her light, cynical, casual chatter, the whisper of her slacks. They went into a steakhouse and Larry cooked, a trifle clumsily, but she applauded each course. The steak, the French fries, the instant coffee, the strawberry rhubarb pie. Chapter 28. There was a strawberry pie in the fridge. It was covered with saran wrap, and after looking at it for a long time with dull and bemused eyes, Franny took it out. She set it on the counter and cut a wedge. A strawberry fell to the counter with a fat plop as she was transferring the piece of pie to a small plate. She picked the berry up and ate it. She wiped up the small splotch of juice on the counter with a dish rag. She put the saran wrap back over the remains of the pie and stuck it back in the refrigerator. She was turning back to get her pie when she happened to glance at the knife rack beside the cupboards. Her father had made it. It was two magnetized runners. The knives hung from them, blades down. The early afternoon sun was gleaming on them. She stared at the knives for a long time, the dull, half-curious cast of her eyes never changing, her hands working restlessly in the folds of the apron tied around her waist. At last, some 15 minutes later, she remembered that she had been in the middle of something. What? A line of scripture, a paraphrase, occurred to her for no good reason. Before removing the mote in thy neighbor's eye, attend the beam in thine own. She considered it. Mote? Beam? That particular image had always bothered her. What sort of beam? Moonbeam? Roof beam? There were also flashlight beams, and beaming faces, and there had been a New York mayor named Abe Beam, not to mention a song she had learned in vacation Bible school, I'll Be a Sunbeam for Him. Before removing the mote in thy neighbor's eye. But it wasn't an eye, it was a pie. She turned to it and saw there was a fly crawling on her pie. She waved a hand at it. Bye-bye, Mr. Fly. Say so long to Franny's pie. She regarded the piece of pie for a long time. Her mother and father were both dead, she knew. Her mother had died in the Sanford Hospital, and her father, who had once made a little girl feel welcome in his shop, was lying dead in bed above her head. Why did everything have to keep coming in rhymes? Coming and going in such dreadful cheap jingles and jangles, like the idiot mnemonics that recur in fevers. My dog has fleas, they bite his knees. She came to her senses suddenly, and a kind of terror twisted through her. There was a hot smell in the room. Something was burning. Franny jerked her head around, saw a skillet of French fries in oil she had put on the stove and then forgotten. Smoke was billowing up from the pan in a stinking cloud. Grease was flying out of the pan in angry splatters, and the splatters that landed on the burner were flaring alight and then going out, as if an invisible butane lighter was being flicked by an invisible hand. The cooking surface of the pan was black. She touched the handle of the pan and drew her fingers back with a little gasp. It was now too hot to touch. She grabbed a dish towel, wrapped it around the handle, and quickly carried the utensil, sizzling like a dragon, out through the back door. She set it down on the top step of the porch. The smell of honeysuckle and the droning of the bees came to her, but she barely noticed. For a moment, the thick, dull blanket which had swaddled all her emotional responses for the last 4 days was pierced, and she was acutely frightened. Frightened? No, in a state of low terror, only a pace away from panic. She could remember peeling the potatoes and putting them into the Wesson oil to cook. Now she could remember. But for a while there she had just... Phew, she had just forgotten. Standing on the porch, dish towel still clutched in one hand, she tried to remember exactly what her train of thought had been after she had put the French fries on to cook. It seemed very important. Well, first she had thought that a meal which consisted of nothing but French fries wasn't very nutritious. Then she'd thought that if the McDonald's down on Route 1 had still been open, she wouldn't have had to cook them herself, and she could have had a burger, too. Just take the car and cruise up to the takeout window. She would get a quarter pounder and the large-size fries, the ones that came in the bright red cardboard container, little grease spots on the inside. Undoubtedly unhealthy, indubitably comforting. And besides, pregnant women get strange cravings. That brought her to the next link in the chain. Thoughts of strange cravings had led to thoughts of the strawberry pie lurking in the fridge. Suddenly it had seemed to her that she wanted a piece of that strawberry pie more than she wanted anything in the world. So she had gotten it, but somewhere along the line her eye had been caught by the knife rack her father had made for her mother. Mrs. Edmonton, the doctor's wife, had been so envious of that knife rack that Peter had made one for her 2 Christmases ago. And her mind had just short-circuited. Motes, beams, flies. "Oh, God," she said to the empty backyard and her father's unweeded garden. She sat down and put the apron over her face and cried. When the tears dried up, she seemed to feel a little better, but she was still frightened. "Am I losing my mind?" she asked herself. "Is this the way it happens, the way it feels when you have a nervous breakdown, or whatever you want to call it?" Since her father had died at 8:30 the night before, her ability to focus mentally seemed to have gotten fragmented. She would forget things she had been doing. Her mind would go off on some dreamy tangent, or she would simply sit, not thinking of anything at all, no more aware of the world than a head of cabbage. After her father died, she had sat beside his bed for a long time. At last she had gone downstairs and turned on the TV. No particular reason. Like the man said, it just seemed like a good idea at the time. The only station broadcasting had been the NBC affiliate in Portland, WCSH, and they seemed to be broadcasting some sort of crazy trial show. A black man, who looked like a Ku Klux Klansman's worst nightmare of headhunting Africans, had been pretending to execute white men with a pistol, while other men in the audience applauded. It had to be pretend, of course. They didn't show things like that on TV if they were real. But it hadn't looked like pretend. It reminded her crazily of Alice in Wonderland, only it wasn't the Red Queen yelling, "Off with their heads," in this case, but what? Who? The Black Prince, she had supposed. Not that the beef in the loincloth had looked much like Prince. Later in the program, how much later she could not have said, some other men broke into the studio, and there was a firefight which was even more realistically staged than the executions had been. She saw men, nearly decapitated by heavy-caliber bullets, thrown backward with blood bursting from their shredded necks in gaudy arterial pumps. She remembered thinking in her disorganized way that they should have put one of those signs on the screen from time to time, the ones that warned parents to put the kiddies to bed or change the channel. She also remembered thinking that WCSH might get their license to broadcast lifted all the same. It really was an awfully bloody program. She switched it off when the camera swung up, showing only the studio lights hanging down from the ceiling, and lay back on the couch, looking at her own ceiling. She had fallen asleep there, and this morning she was more than half convinced that she had dreamed the entire program. And that was the nub, really. Everything had come to seem like a nightmare filled with free-floating anxieties. It had begun with the death of her mother. The death of her father had only intensified what had already been there. As in Alice, things just got curiouser and curiouser. There had been a special town meeting which her father had attended even though he had been getting sick by then himself. Franny, feeling drugged and unreal, but physically no different than ever, had gone with him. The town hall had been crowded, much more crowded than it was for town meetings in late February or early March. There was a lot of sniffling and coughing and kerchewing. The attendees were frightened and ready to be angry at the least excuse. They spoke in loud, hoarse voices. They stood up. They shook their fingers. They pontificated. Many of them, not just the women either, had been in tears. The upshot had been a decision to close off the town entirely. No one would be allowed in. If people wanted to leave, that was fine, as long as they understood that they couldn't come in again. The roads leading in and out of town, most notably US 1, were to be barricaded with cars. After a shouting match that lasted half an hour, that was amended to town-owned public works trucks. And volunteers would stand watches at these roadblocks with shotguns. Those trying to use US 1 to go north or south would be directed up north to Wells or down south to York, where they could get on Interstate 95 and thus detour around a